province of dreamtime. There are no limits. The mind is infinite. Dreamtime. In the province of the mind, what one believes to be true either is true or becomes true within certain limits.
Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and on this show I like to investigate the new paradigms, the new ways we can look at the planet and ourselves and our civilization and where we're evolving to. And one of the key components in that is where we have evolved from. Tonight's guest is John Anthony West, who is a bit of a renegade Egyptologist. He's written a great book called Serpent in the Sky, which takes the findings of a classical Egyptologist named Shuala de Lubitz, and John elaborates on his work and tells us that where we think we've come from and who we think we are is older and more sophisticated than the mainstream historians have told us. And so we'll be exploring the sacred sciences, what are true descendants as spiritual race is on this planet. So thanks, John, for coming.
Thanks, Alan.
Let's really talk about, first of all, your background is Egyptology, but there's a great division between what you call the ancient Egyptians and what the classical or the mainstream Egyptologists say were the Egyptians. So.
Yes, well, actually, let me correct you on one thing. Okay. Actually, Shuala de Lubitz was not a classical Egyptologist. He was a renegade in his own way as well. Mm-hmm. He was a mystic, a scholar, a mathematician, a scientist, deeply versed in the mystical traditions of both East and West, a practicing alchemist, believe it or not. Many other things. He wasn't a classical Egyptologist. If he had been, he wouldn't have discovered anything new in all likelihood.
Well, let's lay out the differences in the two schools of thought.
Right.
There's
right.
You and Shuala de Lubitz, and we'll go into who Shuala was, but
right.
But let's just lay it out so people get it.
Okay,
a
well, I'm sort of, you might say, I'm self-appointed Shuala's Boswell. Mm-hmm. And Shuala, Shuala did something, in my opinion, of inestimable importance in that he documented, after 20 years of work on the site, mainly at the Temple of Luxor, he documented not just the existence, but the inner structure, you might say, the DNA of the ancient sacred science that people have been talking about from classical times. I mean, Plato talks about it. And the knowledge or the belief that a high science existed in deep antiquity has been part of Western thought ever since Plato, really. Mm. But by the modern cast of mind, by what I like to call the Church of Progress, by the rationalists and materialists of the last two centuries, that notion has been poo-pooed and thrown out of court, as it were, almost without investigation. And so what Shuala did was actually to discover that this prodigiously sophisticated corpus or body of knowledge existed in dynastic Egypt, and it was that fueled or that commanded those incredible temples, pyramids, tombs, and so on. So in other words, he not just hypothesized that the science was there, he showed how it was there and how it worked. And in effect, he, I think more than any other single scholar of recent times, or maybe of any time, he was able not just to document, but to show the extent of the ancient science, how it worked, why it was important, and perhaps, by extrapolation, how we might take that knowledge and make use of it for ourselves in forming a new civilization.
So, what were the years that Shuala did his research in Egypt?
1937 to 54.
54, and so he has proved that there was a deeper science behind the architecture and the creation of the Egyptian.
Absolutely, yes.
So what do the mainstream Egyptologists say about Shuala's work?
Well, they have they've pretty much denied its existence for most of the last 40 years. The Temple of Man, the big book, Le Temple de l'Homme, was first published in 57. Before that, there was a kind of a preliminary volume called The Temple in Man that was produced, I think, in 49. And actually, when The Temple of Man came out with this radical theory, one of the eminent Egyptologists of the day even said, outright said it. It's rare that scholars and scientists opposed to a theory will actually come out with a statement as outrageous as this. He said, we must, all of us, meaning the Egyptological community, erect a common wall of silence around this work.
Well,
in other words, they knew it was
fact.
Scary.
I mean, they're ignoring, I mean, what actually did he prove in his massive three-volume book, The Temple of Man, or In Man, of Man?
Well, mainly you might say that he proved that that all of the pyramids, temples, tombs, and so on were based, basically he proved they were based upon mathematics, that it was it was a science of harmony, measure, proportion, myth, symbolism, all of which were interlinked and which were actually they were actually an expression of a profound understanding of cosmogenesis. In other words, the Egyptians understood what we don't know, what we're just fumbling toward. They understood how the universe was created, why it was created, and what the role of humanity was within that grand cosmic scheme. And each of the temples of Egypt, each of the tombs, each of the pyramids, each of them is an element within this tremendous and coherent doctrine.
Each temple of Egypt is an element within the great cosmology.
Each temple is consecrated to one of the gods. We use the word gods as the translation for the Egyptian Neter, or Necher, as they, I'm not sure how it's pronounced.
And that didn't actually mean gods. Or
not to them, no. To them, a much better explanation or a much better translation in our terms would be a natural principle.
So like in other words, archetype, a sort of nature or a principle.
You might say, yes, for example, you might say, you look at an organism, let's say, everything is a result of fertilization, gestation, birth, growth, maturity, senescence or old age, death, renewal, and finally on the highest spiritual level, resurrection or salvation in Christian
terminology. These are the main natural cycles.
These are the main natural principles, you might say. And to each of those principles, the ancient Egyptians applied a name, the embodiment of a principle which had certain attributes. I mean, they'd be represented by an animal or a plant or
The gods themselves were the personifications of these
cyclical changes. Well, they were the personifications of the principles responsible for us being here. So we tend not to think of these things in terms of principle. We're taught that this is all a result of evolution, and by accident somehow or another the universe kind of patch together this strange process that starts with fertilization and ends with renewal.
Which ignores the whole aspect of us being spiritual beings or having an
essence. This is anathema to the Church of Progress. So when someone like Schwaller comes along, or not someone like Schwaller, there's only one of them. When a Schwaller comes along and shows that these Egyptian temples are the result of a profoundly sophisticated science, everybody agrees that these were incredible architects and artists and so on, but it's assumed that at the same time these masterpieces that, unlike anything else the world has yet produced, are the result of or that were produced by people who otherwise were scientifically and philosophically and religiously even quite primitive. This keeps in, let's say, this keeps in place what I call the credo of the reigning religion of the time, which I call the Church of Progress. In other words, with the belief that the Egyptians were relatively primitive beings, we can go on happily believing that we're the most sophisticated and advanced and developed civilization that ever was. So this is where Schwaller is dynamite, because he comes along and, using the ground rules of modern scholarship itself, shows that actually we're not evolved creatures at all. We're involved or devolved. I mean, we know a lot less about what counts than the Egyptians
did. It goes back to the understanding of sacred geometry and sacred science, and also the story of the Golden Age and the Silver Age.
Well, this comes into it, yes.
Right, so we are the remnants of a greatly sophisticated civilization that we only have the faintest traces of, and most people are just ignoring that, saying, never existed.
Well, let's say all of us learned in school. What we're talking about here, none of us have ever learned in school. Yes, we're brought up to believe that we're the acme of civilization, as it were. And so when Schwaller comes along and says it's exactly the opposite, and it's not as though he's being original. After all, the Vedic philosophy is that we're living at the end of the Kali Yuga. Well, this is the Iron Age.
Even the theosophists have said this. I mean, Madame Blavatsky said, you know, she synthesized all the great ancient wisdom and put it together in a
text. Yes, she did. Wherever she got it from, she synthesized it.
Right.
And she's only echoing she's getting most of her knowledge from the Far East. The Egyptians are basically saying the same things. Even they talk about thousands of years of prior Egyptian history, in which Egypt is first ruled by the Neteru, the gods themselves, for thousands of years, and then for another long period of thousands of years by sort of demigod figures called the Shemsuhor, the companions or the followers of Horus, and only after that does dynastic Egypt begin, which is the reign of the divine kings.
Well, that seems to parallel the Vedic scriptures,
so.
When the gods live
and the
descendants of the gods.
And, of course, the mythologies of the world, everywhere, from the Eskimos to the Polynesians to whatever, generally talk about decline, not advance.
Right, but that could...
Even the Old Testament talks about there were giants in those days and so on.
But that might just be mythological creations. But what goes against that is the fact that what you trace in your book, The Serpent in the Sky, and what Schwaller says is that the older you go back, the more sophisticated the Egyptians were. Now, that's something that can't be explained.
Not so easily, anyway. This is right. Now, unmistakably, particularly if we're correct about the age of the Sphinx and all of that, the further you go back, the more perfect, sophisticated, and technologically daunting the work is. And as it progresses in time, it regresses in accomplishment.
Now, how would mainstream Egyptologists explain that?
They don't, basically. They don't. This is one of the
staring them in the face. I
mean, yes, they contend that within a couple of hundred years, from more or less Neolithic beginnings, the Egyptians brought their civilization from not quite hunter-gatherers, but from simple fisher folk and farmers to the ability to build the Great Pyramid and Saqqara and all of these other incredible monuments. And at that point, and even they will acknowledge this, having got to that point, it was sort of downhill from there on in. It's a little bit like saying, with the invention of the automobile in 1892 or whatever, by 1904 we had the best Porsche available, and it's been downhill ever since, and now we have Model T Fords.
It doesn't make sense
the way we do things.
Well, not by any imagination could it make sense that, because even now we don't know how they built the Great Pyramid.
No, we don't. And even the Egyptologists, things actually, I must say, are changing a bit, very slowly in Egyptology, but there's a new, let's say the younger Egyptologists who can manage to stick out the discipline are suddenly getting, at least in private, pretty interested in Schwaller de Lubitsch, and his work filters in through, if you read some of the Egyptological literature, I could detect that said, aha, that's somebody knows their Schwaller there. They might not be mentioning him by name, but there's a general upgrading of opinion vis-a-vis Schwaller. However, it's a long way from acknowledging that, hey, this is the ancient sacred science, and it behooves us to learn it.
It seems like it'll go with the parallel development in our culture as we become a more spiritual culture, let's say. Will the ancient history kind of play out that we actually descended from spiritual cultures? So it just seems like as we change our opinions and the way we understand ourselves today, the history will change. And as we become more integrated into a body-mind-spirit approach, that's what we'll understand about the ancient Egyptians.
Well, I believe you seem to think that that's a foregone conclusion. I'm by no means certain that it's a foregone conclusion.
In other words,
that we're moving in this direction and we'll get there. I see a movement in that direction, but it's up to us to make it happen. It's not going to just, the clock is not going to chime Aquarius, as it were, and suddenly Right. Everyone's going to be enlightened.
No, but it is chiming something. There is a spiritual revolution.
Well, there's
people reading.
There's
you know.
A spiritual interest. Yeah, revolution is actually acting upon the stuff. The
bestseller list has books like by Deepak Chopra and Conversations with God, and I mean, there's people showing an interest.
Oh, there's a big interest in it, but this is a long way from doing something about it.
Yeah, but it's the beginning
It's like everybody being interested in football, but it only happens if a few guys play it very well.
But getting back to what Shwala Dlugacz actually proved is that this civilization of Egypt was not actually a development, it was a legacy.
Yeah, this
which
is
was
another
handed
aspect.
Down.
Well, this is, of course, one of the most attractive parts of the whole thing because, even if all of this stuff took place, all of the pyramids and Sphinx and all of the rest, it took place in dynastic times, that's inexplicable to begin with. But if the theory based on Shwala's observation about the water weathering of the Sphinx is correct, and the whole thing has to be pushed back somewhere around 10,000 BC and maybe even the processional cycle before that, 36,000 BC, which strangely enough coincides with the Egyptians' own account in a broad sort of sense, and also actually with the Vedas, which talk about there's a 40,000 year period that the Vedas assign. I forget, I'm not that much up on
Well, just
on
to
Vedic
tell people
knowledge.
Is that you noticed a line in one of Shwala Dlugacz's books about the watering of the Sphinx.
Water
which,
weathering, yes.
But no one ever heard of that, or no one even picked up on it until you took geologists to the Sphinx and, and they said, yes, the Sphinx has had water.
That's right.
Dripping
on
it. And that predates the Sphinx to at least 10,000 years.
Almost certainly, because actually, basically, the Sahara has only been desert since about 10,000 BC, so the Sphinx has been weathered by water, specifically by rain, lots of it over long periods of time. It has to have been built during or before the time when Egypt had lots of water, and that predates 10,000 BC, probably coeval with the melting of the last ice age somewhere around between 13,000 and 11,000 BC. Paleoclimatologists, those are scientists who study ancient climates, say that during this period, Egypt was subject to tremendous rains. I mean, the whole world was actually subject to huge cataclysmic conditions, earthquakes.
Which is the sinking of Atlantis, if we want to get into that.
Well, Plato is correct. Yes, it's according to Plato, and that's the only source of the Atlantis story, actually.
Yes.
But according to Plato, around 9600 BC, a great civilization. If you follow Plato's mapping, as it were, people think the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, but doesn't necessarily have to be there.
Why is it called the Atlantic Ocean?
It's called that because of Plato's story, that's
exactly.
right.
Exactly.
But until you find Atlantis in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, that's Plato's story.
Well, you know, the Atlantic Ocean was unnavigable to the Greeks and probably to the Europeans till about 1400 in the southern part. I mean, they were great sailors. Why didn't they ever cross the ocean? Because all that cataclysmic upheaval was still settling. The Gulf Stream was still settling. And I think it settled in the north, this is just my theory, first. So that's why the Norsemen were able to cross the northern Atlantic, but still the middle European countries weren't able to sail across because it was still settling until about 1400 when Columbus sailed.
Depends who you read. No, because if you read Barry Fell, America B.C. and Saga America, which of course the opposition will not countenance, according to Barry Fell, there was lots of trade, or lots of, let's say, intercourse between the old world and the new, back in, according to Barry Fell, the Libyans and the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans and the Arabs, certainly up to about 800 or so BC, regularly visited America. There were Romans coins found in Indiana and things like that. Yeah. There's a ton of evidence that says that up to about 600 or 700 AD, there was routine trade and intercourse between the two worlds, and that for reasons not really known, but more or less coinciding with the so-called Dark Ages, it stopped until probably the Vikings came across.
Is this the forbidden archaeology
people? Well, forbidden archaeology goes into that, but this is much earlier.
What
this
book is that?
A very interesting guy now dead called Barry Fell, who was a professor emeritus from Harvard. I mean, all the credentials you could possibly ask for. Got very interested in ancient scripts and this sort of thing. These are big bestsellers in the 70s. The first one was, I think, America B.C., the second, Saga America. It had kind of the effect on the academic establishment of its time as our water weathering theory had about the Sphinx today. I mean, it was attacked, and even Fell, whose credentials were impeccable, was attacked as though he were a lunatic. And I felt he made his case very, very well. He might have made some mistakes, everyone does. But.
Well, getting back to the water weathering, that was featured on a documentary that was done for NBC, was it?
NBC, originally,
and it was called
The Mystery of the Sphinx, hosted by Charlton Heston.
And you had a major part in
that.
Well,
it's my theory. It's Schwaller's observation, and I put teeth into it by finding Robert Schock, the geologist, and then we presented it in front of the Geological Society of America's sort of Super Bowl of Geology convention in 91. That set off the headlines.
Just proved that it was weathered, but it could have been from some rainfall that happened after 10,000 BC, right? Like, you know, when they said it was built, it could have been a heavy year of rainfall.
But it's not really. Well, according to Schock, there were periods of rain after Egypt became desert.
Right.
But for a variety of reasons, actually very complicated, that I really won't go into here, I think you have to take it back to the earlier date. Schock, we have a bit of a disagreement between ourselves about this. It's not even a disagreement, it's just a different read on the evidence. And Schock, by nature, as a hardcore scientist, takes the most conservative position possible and says that the Sphinx has to be at least 5,000 BC or 7,000 years old, because after that time there was no rain to speak of. It basically the same conditions we have now, or an inch or so of rain a year around the Giza Plateau. This is not enough to create the dramatic water weathering patterns that we see on the Sphinx and on a couple of other linked structures on the Giza Plateau, but not elsewhere in Egypt.
I see. So he says it's 5,000, and you say it's 10,000.
Well, he says the most conservative dating possible is 5,000 BC, and I say, for a variety of reasons, that it doesn't really hold, because if it were that recent, you would expect conditions had settled by then. You would expect that a civilization capable of producing the Sphinx and its attendant temples would not just leave that as their only structures, as their only evidence. Uh-huh. You would expect a lot more there if the date were as recent as 5,000 BC, whereas the earlier date, we're talking about cataclysmic conditions, and it's not so surprising that there's nothing left, or anyway, not much visible left. See, my contention is that if we were given permission, and maybe we will now, because there's this new sort of friendly relationship between ourselves and the opposition.
The opposition maybe, being the conservative.
Orthodox Egyptology,
yes,
yeah.
Right.
That with a bit of luck, if we can get the permission to go in and continue with our work with seismographs and ground-penetrating radar, we may be able, I know places where I think are sensitive spots, let's say, to look, and we may yet find the ruins of major structures under the sand where no one has thought to look, because when they get down to the Old Kingdom, they reckon that's as far back as it goes.
Right.
But there are certain places, particularly Dendera and Abydos and Saqqara, three major sites which you know,
right,
you've been to Egypt,
yes,
where I think the chances are maybe pretty good that if we go banging around there with the seismographs and the radar, that we might actually come up with still further evidence. See, this is one of the better arguments against us. How can the Sphinx be the only piece of evidence that there is?
The Sphinx is much older than the pyramids, according to some, you know, people.
Yeah, well, we're quite happy, and when I say we, Schock, myself, and then Robert Bovall and Graham Hancock, who've developed this astronomical theory, which actually buttresses supports
your geological theory.
Our geological thesis. Right. So we have two quite hard sciences saying, hey, this is a lot older. In any event, the pyramids, we feel, the existing pyramids, were actually built about the time when the Egyptologists say they were, because of certain star alignments.
Which is what year?
Around 2500 BC.
Oh, really?
However, because, yeah, this is, we think this is particularly Bobal's, the star alignments of the of those star shafts and the
Because I thought it was King's much chamber. Older, the
no.
pyramids.
Well, no, but we think, we feel on the basis of we think, quite solid evidence that the present pyramids are built when they're supposed to have been built by those pharaohs, Khufu, Khafra, and Menkaure, but they either replace entirely or are superimposed upon the remnants of structures that were built whenever it was that the Sphinx was built.
Oh.
And to a certain extent, this is, I think, provable, particularly if you look at the second pyramid, the Khafra pyramid, you see that the bottom courses of it are built of these gigantic blocks of stone, hundreds of tons of stone, and then over these courses of stone are the typical Old Kingdom, rougher-looking masonry that you see in the Great Pyramid and in the Menkaure Pyramid. And so this, and this is only a bit of the evidence. There's other internal evidence of, or stylistic evidence that says you're talking about two very different periods of construction. So, yes, the pyramids are built when the Egyptologists say they were built. They can't be wrong all the time. And
you have to give them something, right?
Something. Actually, they've got to give them a lot. They do a lot of very, very careful work, and it's the interpretation of that work that we disagree radically upon.
Yeah.
But they're based upon, in other words, or they replace, superimposed upon, much earlier structures. And we think we can put up some pretty good evidence that says that those that two-stage construction is is a fact, and that, and when you see two different stylistic, two different architectural styles, you know that you're talking about two different periods. I mean, in our own period, for example, of compressed, where things happen faster, when you see a building that's gone up in 1960, you know that it didn't go up in 1860 because of the style,
even,
and vice versa.
Even decade to decade, the 50s, 60s, 70s.
Right. Absolutely. You can't miss it. Style.
It's that obvious in the Egyptian.
It's pretty obvious everywhere, except in certain cases where, let's say, in Victorian times, they mimicked Gothic architecture. So there are, like, the Houses of Parliament are meant to look Gothic, but an architect or an architectural historian knows in 2 seconds that the Houses of Parliament are Victorian, fake Gothic, and not Chartres Cathedral or Notre Dame, which is real Gothic.
Right. I'm talking to John Anthony West, the author of Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Egypt, and we're going to be getting into, in this next part, into more sophisticated understandings of how he explains the higher wisdom of the ancient Egyptian civilization. So I'd like to just talk about, then, you also say about the Sphinx that maybe it was, this is a hypothesis, that planted there as a marker for civilizations to start to take root around the Giza Plateau. Remember that part in the book where you say that maybe, I think it's you or here, that
I didn't say it. Whatever I said, I didn't say that quite that way.
Well, it was something like, this may have been much earlier, the Sphinx may have been a much earlier marker when Memphis, the city of Cairo, was Memphis, right? Or around that
Memphis,
area?
Memphis, yeah. Cairo didn't exist at the time.
And then there was
Memphis is to the south of the Sphinx of Giza.
And let's say there was some lost civilization that came there and erected the Sphinx as a kind of center point of where they were going to start to create this movement of a civilization. Does that sound familiar in that book?
Not me. That's not me.
All right, let me take a bit.
That's probably Graham. That's probably Hancock talking that way. And even that's not quite what Graham would have said. But yeah, Graham and Bobal think that the Sphinx and everything around it, but centering on the Sphinx, because we're quite confident that the dating of the Sphinx will stand the test of time.
Right.
But the Sphinx represents Zeptepi, what Bobal calls the first time. In other words, the origins of Egyptian civilization. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% happy with that. I'm not so sure that the first time is...
It's a marker for the beginning of the Egyptian civilization.
That's right, and corresponds actually to the... It kind of screams out Age of Leo to you. I mean, with the lion body and the and the human head, or the Leo Aquarius axis, it kind of jumps at you. And then Bhavan and Hancock do this very interesting astronomical analysis showing that at 10,500 BC, and incidentally the cycle before that as well, I mean,
which is another 26,000.
And I mean, 10,500 is outrageous enough as far as academia is concerned, right. So I tend not to publicly talk too much about the possibility that it's still the earlier cycle.
Let's talk about that, because...
But for a variety of internal reasons, the earlier period, A, corresponds to the Egyptians' own texts, where they talk about these long reigns, but when Egypt was ruled by the gods themselves and then by the companions of Horus. It corresponds to the Vedic scriptures talking about the origins of their civilization. And if the hypothesis is correct, if the scenario is correct, that around 10,000, 11,000 BC, the whole world is in this terrific climatic turmoil.
Which the Bible, all the old religions talk about a
deluge.
Flood
and deluge and cataclysms and Sodom and Gomorrah and all of this sort of thing.
And even scientists says there was a huge ice age, like you said.
Oh, the ice age, and actually it's from science, it's from absolutely hard-nosed science that we draw this scenario of earthquakes and sea levels rising hundreds of feet.
Something happened 10,000 years. Yeah. I mean, if we take all the evidence.
The main bone of contention, and it's a very big dinosaur-sized bone, is whether or not there was a sophisticated civilization that went down in under those cataclysmic conditions. But anyway, my reasoning of suggesting a still more outrageous date is that if this scientific scenario is indeed correct, and I mean this there's not much argument. The argument is over whether or not there's a sophisticated civilization at that time. But if the scenario is correct, then it would be very difficult under those unsettled conditions to produce something like the Sphinx and whatever the original pyramids might have been and so on. So I certainly keep open the possibility that it's still older, that we're talking about a still earlier processional cycle. But what the Sphinx certainly seems to, as I said, screams at you is Age of Leo, Leo marker as an equinoctium. And this is when, I mean, according to the processional cycle, 10,000 or 36,000 BC, is when Leo was rising in front of the rising sun on the spring equinox, just as now we're in the last stages of Pisces, and shortly, soon, in X number of years, the sun will be rising against the first degrees of Aquarius.
It's interesting, all this stuff is coming back around the Sphinx into Aquarius.
Right. We're exactly a half cycle away, a half processional cycle, or a half platonic, a half great year away from that Sphinx Leo cycle. Yes, which of course the astrologers and a lot of other people, me included, think this could be something of considerable significance. Obviously, the academic opposition doesn't think that there's any significance to the so-called ages at all. It's strictly an astronomical phenomenon, according to them.
And you know, they're just looking at the superficial layer, but because in your book, Serpents in the Sky, and what you talk about, Schwaller's work, is that there's evidence in the sacred geometries that we have inherited a legacy of sacred science. The fact that, you know, our consciousness has descended into the physical realms in order to play in this universe.
Yeah, but see, when you use the word superficial,
yeah,
that isn't even the right word, because by their standards, it's not a question of superficial. By their standards, the word sacred itself is almost a synonym for superstition. In other words, they don't think there is any depth.
Well, that's the
thing. They don't think there is spirit.
Right. So in your book, you go into how numbers do have a sacred significance. So how would you define the word sacred? I mean, I have as pertaining to the sense that we are greater than the physical plane, that there's a knowingness that we are more than our physical bodies, and that knowingness is an understanding of what is sacred. That's how I would define it.
Yeah. Let's say the hypothesis, the credo, it isn't even a hypothesis, it's a belief. I mean, and a very passionately held belief among rationalists and materialists, that matter precedes mind. In other words, and spirit, if you want to call it that, is an aspect of mind, but all of this is an accidental sort of an accidental throw-off, an accidental byproduct of blind evolution, and that we're simply accidents, and that all of religion is a big mistake.
Right. I mean, I know that. I mean,
so you can't, but you can't prove that.
You can't not prove it. I mean, they.
Either way, you can't prove it. So in other words, finally, it's your own experience. And if you can, one of the great things about sacred art, particularly Egypt, where there's so much left, if you can walk into these incredible places and not be emotionally affected, not realize that you're in the presence of higher powers, of divinity, whatever word you want to use to express your own, let's say, that inner gut,
awareness,
profound experience, if you don't get that, it's not that you're rational and the guys who feel it are superstitious, it's that if you don't feel it, it means there's something deeply wrong with you. You're emotionally defective and spiritually dyslexic.
Spiritually dyslexic.
Yeah, well, this is the whole of modern, let's say, of the materialist.
Yes, but let's not even talk about that. I mean, it's like the old saying, those that know, no proof is necessary, and those that don't, no proof is possible, you know?
That's
so
right.
It's like this
yes.
great polarity. So let's
right.
talk about the knowing part, and, you know, if people don't follow this discussion of sacred, then, you know, maybe they'll say, well, maybe there is
they
something
can turn
to
on Jerry Springer.
That's right. But, you know, at least to plant a seed, and it's more what I want to know is this idea of the sacred and the legacy that the Egyptians have left us as we developed into this Western civilization, because the Greeks seem to have gotten most of their central concepts from the Egyptians.
Greeks said so themselves, and
that's
this
right.
is, again, this was accepted at face value up until the 19th century. Mm. When suddenly the Church of Progress started supplanting the degenerate churches that were around at the time, and suddenly it became a kind of, actually, it's a kind of, as was shown by the very interesting Cornell scholar, Bernal, what was his first name? Martin Bernal, in his extraordinary book, Black Athena, that really what we're taught as history is a kind of Eurocentric white supremacist fantasy that has very little to do with reality. But it was at that time that modern, what we call history, was cooked up by a bunch of scholars who had to have, I mean, A, we're the most progressive people that ever were, and B, progress has to have been a European invention, and therefore it had to come from the Greeks, because they, even though they're from the south and they're sort of swarthy kind of characters, but they're white enough, it couldn't come from Egypt or from Israel or from Syria or from Africa or anything like that.
Well, it seems like the race of Egyptians don't even exist anymore. Who the original ancient Egyptians were seem to be wiped off the face of the earth, or at least invaded by the Semitic tribes.
No.
You don't think so?
Absolutely not.
That's because I don't see any evidence for the same people that exist in the hieroglyphs that exist today.
Absolutely, as a matter of fact.
You
too? Oh, you walk around Egypt. In fact, we even have some of it in the Mystery of the Sphinx. I'm all the time, knowing Egypt as well as I know it, I'm all the time meeting friends of my friends in Egypt and saying, gee, that guy looks like the statue in the Cairo Museum. I met a woman architect there that I was quite friendly with for a while. We were talking about joint projects. I kept looking at her. I said, she reminds me of somebody, One day I was in the Cairo Museum. I suddenly realized, and I said, oh, she looks exactly like Queen Hatshepsut. And then when I saw her next, I said,
that's,
you know, this
funny.
Is meant as a compliment. Do other people, does anybody else said that? She's, oh, everybody tells me that all the time. There was actually a book of photographs printed in the 50s that I saw in her office, and it would be a great book to reprint, of a photographer who went around Egypt, spent a couple of years doing it, photographing contemporary Egyptians and matching them to the famous statues and reliefs and so on. No, they're the same, because actually the Egyptians have stayed.
They weren't invaded by the
almost not. No, you see,
Islam.
Egypt is a very, they were invaded by, I mean, Muhammad Omar.
Right.
Swept through in 640 and conquered. And Egypt has been conquered a number of times.
Right.
But Egypt is a very easy country to rule, or was before modern technology.
Right.
Whoever controlled the Nile controlled the country. So it was never actually colonized, except for far in the north, where the Greeks colonized fairly extensively following Alexander.
Right.
But otherwise, the Egyptians are pretty much the same Egyptians that they were before. They didn't travel much. So far in the south, it's all Nubians, and, you know, everybody looks like Nubians, and they're still Nubians. And you get to Luxor, they're the middle Egyptians, and they look like the Stats. They stayed. I mean, they were a mix to begin with, but they're the same mix that they are now. They haven't changed.
But let's get back to the discussion on the sacred context of the ancient Egyptians and the you call it the symbolist.
Yes.
Identity.
Symbolist. It's called a symbolist school, both by adherents like myself and by detractors like. Or opponents like most classical Egyptologists.
So if we say that this great spiritual culture existed in Egypt where they knew what their connection to the stars and to their own inner nature was,
yes.
what do you see as evidence of that? Or what did Schwaller, who really kind of decoded it and you know, said that this is true because of his hermetic learnings as an alchemist and all that spiritual knowledge that came from the West, he saw was a descendant of the Egyptian thought.
Exactly. Yes, he did. That's exactly what he saw. And he was able to demonstrate, and this is where the Egyptologists really are responsible, because when he gets to talking about the geometry of the temple and the precise measures and the Egyptian measures themselves, which are earth commensurate,
right.
And he starts being able to show why the geometry is as it is in that spectacular temple of Luxor, well, either he's right or he's wrong. In other words, either the geometry is correct. The measurements are absolutely rigorous, and in fact, contemporary Egyptologists use those measurements and say so.
Right.
But as far as the interpretation is concerned, he offers an interpretation of those geometrical proportionate harmonic facts. Those are facts. The measurements are facts.
And what is his interpretation? Because I think that's very important that people know.
Well, that these are, in other words...
We don't have to support the other argument
at
all.
No, that's right. But, that all of this, that the measurements and so on, are based upon this complete science of cosmogenesis, that is to say, of the birth of the cosmos. Mm-hmm. All of Egypt, you might say, is an attempt... It's an ongoing exercise in high ceremonial magic. In other words, Egypt is in fact, the texts are even formal about this, an image of heaven, of the heavens.
Uh-huh.
And in recreating the image of the heavens, the people who are doing the recreation are actually repeating the divine act of creation itself. They are participating. Uh-huh. They're participating in the birth of the cosmos, and ostensibly, doing the kind of work that is necessary to raise their own consciousness to the divine level. That's the purpose of Egypt. I mean, Egypt is a one-issue civilization. They're interested in one thing and one thing only, and that is the immortality of the soul. Uh-huh. That is all they're interested in.
So they knew they were a microcosm of the heavens.
Absolutely.
And they knew by their actions that it would then connect them to the stars.
Yes, they knew actually their understanding was, and you see the Egyptologists say it was, they wouldn't even disagree with this. They say they would say it's their belief. I would say, no, it wasn't their belief. They knew.
They knew.
Didn't know. They couldn't have acted like that for 3,000 years. But anyway, leave that alone, because it's the sort of thing you can't actually prove.
Right.
But the understanding was that the realized or the divinized or the exalted or the enlightened soul arrived at a level of stellar consciousness. In other words, the stars are higher conscious beings. And again, this is formal. I mean, the texts use this language, and there's one.
This stuff is much more interesting than just saying, you know, they were superstitious. This stuff resonates in me as a truth. Because
me too. But right. I don't share the belief that we're particularly progressive beings. But if you passionately believe, and it's the only thing that you believe, that we live in an advanced and developed society rather than a deeply degenerate one, this kind of demonstration is anathema, and so resisted.
I don't care. I mean, yes, of course.
You have to care because
let's take what you've learned and what you've translated from Schwaller and talk about how that can be applicable to this civilization today, because I think it really is, as we come into a greater awareness. I mean, Schwaller said there is nothing but consciousness. That's a quote in one of his books.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
And so he knew that the Egyptians, or he felt, were aware of that same...
Absolutely, yes. Oh, yeah, the Egyptians, and this again, the texts are formal, the Egyptians, and actually virtually every religious formulation of philosophy agrees with this, that matter, the material universe, is an aspect or a concretization of spirit. In other words,
right.
The Egyptians, the American Indians say, you know, everything is spirit, a tree, a rock, all is spirit. This is the exact opposite of Church of Progress
right.
philosophy, that would have it that mind or consciousness is an accidental byproduct of matter, which is the primordial stuff, although even there they're in trouble because suddenly they've got energy to contend with.
Suddenly they have consciousness, which doesn't seem to fit along with a concept. But if
we
take the Egyptian or what what Schwaller says is the understanding of the Egyptian, what relevance is it for us today? What can we learn from that as spiritual beings? I mean, what did they know in their spiritual consciousness that we can use?
They knew, it's a very important point, because if it's just academic, and we're busy proving that the academic Egyptologists have it wrong, that's not worth wasting your life on.
Exactly,
who cares?
Yeah.
But actually, to me, they ancient Egypt is a kind of an exemplar, a model of how civilized human beings once comported themselves. So the principles upon which Egypt is based are eternal. We wouldn't build pyramids and temples and stuff like that again. But the notion that you can build a building, a temple, let's say, that's consecrated to one of the neters or principles, and when you walk through there, when you've been to Egypt, you know, you get this tremendous emotional rush when you walk in certain of these places, different ones.
I could stay all day in the corner of some of those temples. Yeah.
What you're getting actually is this is the evocation of the principle of the neter. In other words, sacred architecture puts you in touch with the divine principle that is enshrined in that building via its harmonies, its proportions, its measures, its symbolism, and so on. So even though it is an alien symbolism that we only barely understand today, when you walk into one of those temples, you are participating, let's say, in Amun consciousness or Horus consciousness.
Because it resonates with our body.
Because it's resonating, it is, as Goethe calls it, the architecture is frozen music. So just as you resonate to music, be it the Star Spangled Banner or the Rolling Stones or Beethoven's late quartets. So when you walk into an Egyptian temple, you are resonating with the god, as it were. So when you have an entire society that's devoted to not honoring or not just honoring or propitiating the gods, but to establishing their reign on earth, and you have a whole civilization devoted to this, then you've got a real civilization going. So it stands. We wouldn't do it that way again, but the knowledge that it can be done, that by studying this stuff and studying it the right way and reestablishing the ancient science and putting it into terms that we can deal with our own form of intelligence and our own way of looking at things, which is definitely not the Egyptian way, we can, with a bit of luck, reestablish that kind of, let's say, divinely inspired or divinely orchestrated or divinely attuned civilization on earth again. And it's only when we have that kind of attunement, or that's our goal, that you have a civilization. That's why we don't have a civilization now. All we have is technological, you know, we have shiny barbarism.
Civilization being defined as a culture that's evolving towards some higher goal, or
I would say so, it's one definition. I've got a definition in The Serpent, that a civilization occurs when human beings understand that they're on this earth for a purpose and devote their energies toward realizing that purpose. And without that,
as a community, the civilization.
Well, a number of, there's critical mass. I mean, if just a couple of people do it, it's not going to take anything very far, particularly if the rest of the people are doing the opposite. But if lots of people are doing it, then you have the possibility of a civilization.
Well, that's what you just said about it's the architecture having a resonance with the human body and actually altering states and building an awareness in the participants in that culture is something that's starting to take place now. Also in your book, you also mentioned, talking about architecture, that none of the architectural ideas were ever recorded in hieroglyphs, which is amazing. That was kept secret.
You never see architects at work. They've got a couple of papyrus plans or blueprints, so you knew that they drew the stuff down.
Yeah.
But what made them do a temple one way rather than another was never written down to the best of our knowledge. probably that was, I mean, the Egyptians certainly had secret knowledge. In other words, they talk about secret knowledge all the time.
They do talk about it.
Except they don't tell you what the secrets are.
What you're saying is that, you know, the architects, the masons, was the most sacred of the arts. And masons have a tradition.
The masons believe,
yes,
that their own doctrine or their own, whatever you want to call it, their own, I guess doctrine isn't the right word. Their own thesis, their own wisdom, whatever you want to call it, goes back to ancient Egypt, and via a number of interesting books, among them Graham Hancock's original Sign and the Seal, but there are plenty of other books. That said, the Charpentier, the book on the cathedrals, I think it may not be a direct lineage, but quite possibly an indirect lineage that came to the Masons via the Templars, who were among the, you know, the crusading monks, sorry, the crusading knights, who may have picked it up in Ethiopia or may have picked it up from
The Sufis, or
the guardians of Islam.
But do you think they never recorded their hieroglyphs about building anything? Was because it was so sacred, because it had an effect on consciousness, that it was something that you couldn't share with the rest of the world?
Well, maybe. I mean, the Egyptians, they keep talking about sacred knowledge. Even in medicine, they talk about, there's a lot of their medical papyruses, and then there's plans that said, this is the secret knowledge handed only down from master to pupil, and so on. Because they understood, and I mean, quite rightly, in our age of hydrogen bombs and nerve gas, it hardly seems, you know, you don't really think of let's say, of architecture as dangerous.
Right.
But in fact, if you can actually alter people's consciousness for good by building the right kind of temple, you can sure as hell alter it for ill by building the wrong kind of temple.
It's like
advertising is a form of sorcery.
Right.
Bends people's wills to buy a whole bunch of rubbish that they don't actually need.
Right.
So this is the power of persuasion. If you actually knew what you were doing, I mean, marketing, advertising, you know, Madison Avenue are very highly paid, inept sorcerers. But still, the stuff works. And if you get people who really know what they're doing,
yes,
for ill, and you have a society of black magicians, you can do a lot of damage.
So that's why they never let their sacred knowledge out.
That's right. Later on, when the Greeks got hold of some of those secrets,
right,
Pythagoras also, on pain of expulsion and death, certain knowledge was kept secret. But when the Pythagorean order fell apart, a number of the ex-Pythagoreans started blabbing about the secrets. The Egyptians were much better at keeping their secrets, because to the best of our knowledge, they took into their graves with them.
But what other aspects of this sacred society is still available for us to learn from? I mean, yes, we have the resonance of the architecture, and we have the understanding of sacred numbers, how that can
also... to reacquire it. Well, that's enough, actually.
Well,
I mean, visit Egypt, you've been there.
Yeah.
See it for yourself. I mean, my introduction to Schwaller, but now the great, huge, two-volume Temple of Man is now available in English, as a matter of fact. So for those who are willing to take a year off from whatever they're doing and try and plow their way through this extraordinary book, there's enough knowledge there to begin to start to recreate these kinds of things. I mean, if I had the money and I were building a house or something for myself, I would work with an architect or a couple of architects and try and build a harmonically designed sacred structure, proper to a house, let's say, or if I were building, you know, it's now again, you can think this way again, mainly because of Schwaller.
So if you're proven right, if Schwaller is proven right, that yes, the Egyptian civilization is much older than we
let's say if it's proven,
unrefutable evidence,
right,
and that it comes from a legacy of a still older civilization,
so it's kind of presupposes, right?
How does that affect us now? What do you see the ramifications of that being?
Well, it could be very profound, as a matter of fact. I mean, we might stop behaving in quite the way that we do, or at least some of us would, in terms of plundering the planet, in terms of thinking that we can do whatever we damn please because we're the most advanced beings that ever were. If suddenly, you know, people start taking seriously the notion that we really are on this earth for a purpose, and that purpose is something more, a little bit more exalted than the bottom line, then everything starts changing. It was Victor Hugo who said, there's one thing more powerful than all the armies in the world, and that's an idea whose time has come.
Right.
This is always taken to mean that the idea has to be a good one. It doesn't. Right. It can be a wrong idea. I mean, along comes Hitler and a very bad idea.
Right.
Its time has come. And along comes Charles Darwin and materialism and atheism. All of these are ideas whose times have come.
Well,
second most, what Hugo forgot.
Yeah.
What Hugo forgot, actually, was that the second most powerful thing in the world is an idea whose time has not yet gone.
Ooh.
So we're now living at the kind of, at a fulcrum of an age in which I think there's an idea out there, a very old idea, whose time is about to come. And at the same time, we're living in a civilization whose time has not quite yet gone, although an awful lot of people are getting pretty uneasy.
Well, that's the reason why I do this show, because I know we're at this fork in the road, mm-hmm. where we're at the precipice, uh-huh. where one thing is about to materialize, appear, that we are these great beings that have some higher connection than just arbitrary evolution, Darwinian right. thought tells us.
Yeah.
And that we're about to realize our divine connection. This is a belief system I
well,
have.
Well, so but you use the right image. If we're at the fork in the road, you can go that way.
Yes.
Or you can go the other way.
There's That's
nothing.
Right.
We haven't yet gone that way.
No, but
my
some
opinion.
Of us are more down that road.
Some of us maybe have, or course, at least we think we've taken it.
But of course, you know what Yogi Berra says: if you see a fork in the road, take it.
Right. I didn't know that one actually. I like that.
But still, I think it's. It's the evidence that you show in your reports on the Sphinx mm-hmm. and the reports on Shuala and what science is dealing in quantum physics and this whole idea of consciousness being, as Goswami says, the ground of all being, mm-hmm. consciousness, and also the ancient Vedas, is an idea whose time has come, definitely, and I think we're gaining momentum, and we'll probably have to rewrite history because of that. Your work is so much more interesting than just the straightforward. Yeah, this.
I think so too. I mean, if you really want a sleepy weekend, yeah. go to a classical Egyptological conference. I mean, this is
right. But what you were saying about the metaphysical connections and our connections to the stars is a whole thesis that could really be developed, and we've just touched upon it here.
Oh, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah.
Is there anything you want to say about that before we sign off? Other, just like seeds to plant in someone's mind about not just the Egyptian culture, but in general, a greater metaphysical connection.
Simply that Egypt, you know, that Egypt was a civilization that understood that we're not sort of accidental glitches in an unconscious universe, but that we are here in order to become divine, as it were, in order to become conscious beings, and Egypt, what's left of it, stands as a model of a civilization devoted to that aim, and it's only that aim that actually makes any sense. I mean, if that's not your aim, you might as well, you know, just kind of sit around and get drunk and drink as much beer as you can and watch the Super Bowl. It's not the most productive way in the world to spend your life. And Egypt stands, as I say, as a model of how a true civilization conducts itself, so we can learn from them.
Mm, great. Thanks for coming and talking.
Thanks, Alan.
This is New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld. If you want to reach me about anything you've heard here, you can call 212-473-6388. Thanks for watching. My guest has been John Anthony West, author of Serpent in the Sky, and what are the books?
Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, The Case for Astrology, and some out-of-print novel, an out-of-print book of short stories, some plays, film scripts, and so on.
And we'll be hearing more from you, too.
Thanks, Alan. Yes, you will.
Thanks for watching. See you next time.
Okay.